content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is George Douglas from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And this week we're reading from The Week magazine, dated August 17th, 2012. As always, we'll begin with the main story section, the first article of the week, A White Supremacist Murderous Rampage. Federal investigators were probing the seedy world of America's white supremacist movement this past week after an avowed neo-Nazi shot dead 6 people and wounded 3 others at a Sikh temple in suburban Milwaukee. Wade Michael Page, a 40-year-old Army veteran who had the date 9/11 and racist symbols tattooed on his arms and body, opened fire on an Indian American worshippers with a semi-automatic handgun as they filed into the temple for meditation. "He did not speak," said Harpreet Singh. "He just began shooting." The temple's president, Satwant Singh Kaleka, 65 years old, bravely fought with the gunman, buying time for others to hide, before taking 2 final shots. When police arrived, Page shot Lieutenant Brian Murphy 8 to 9 times at close range as he tended to a victim in the parking lot. Another officer returned fire, hitting Page, who then killed himself with a shot to the head. Murphy, 51, was in critical condition at press time. The FBI said Page acted alone, and it was investigating the attack as a possible act of domestic terrorism. The Southern Poverty Law Center, which monitors the white supremacist movement, had been tracking Page for a decade because of his involvement with neo-Nazi organizations and racist skinhead bands such as End Apathy, Aggressive Force, and Definite Hate. One song he played featured the lyric, "Wake up, white man, for your race and your land." Mark Potok, a senior fellow at the SPLC, said his organization had insufficient evidence to report Page to a law enforcement agency. "There are tens of thousands of people like this," he said. Now here's what the editorial said. "Another week, another act of senseless violence," said the Louisville Courier-Journal. "Page bought his murder weapon legally, just as accused killer James Holmes legally acquired an assault rifle and 6,000 rounds of ammunition before the recent Colorado cinema shooting. The Second Amendment guarantees our right to bear arms, but in 1791 that meant a musket, not semi-automatic weapons and bullet magazines designed for instantaneous mass slaughter. No law will ever keep guns out of the hands of those intent on killing," said the Boston Herald, "nor will there ever be a fail-safe way to identify extremists and mentally ill people prone to violence until, of course, it's too late. Why Page targeted the peaceful 6 remains a mystery. He might have mistaken them for Muslims, as Sikh men wear turbans and have beards. But then perhaps haters with a slim grip on reality don't really need a reason." Now here's what the columnist said. "Page's radicalization began in the military," said James Dow in the New York Times. "While serving in the Army from 1992 to 1998, when he was discharged for being drunk on duty, the gunman fraternized with neo-Nazi sympathizers and developed a resentment of black soldiers who he believed got all the promotions and were not disciplined for misconduct. After leaving the military, he quickly built up a resume of racist tattoos," said David Lee in the New York Post. "His left shoulder bore a simple print of the number 14, shorthand for the white supremacist credo, 'We must secure the existence of our people and a future for white children.' We ignore these hate groups and our perils," said Errol Lewis in the DailyBeast.com. "In 2009, the Department of Homeland Security warned that the election of the first African-American president had enraged extreme right-wing organizations and racist lone wolves. creating a real danger of domestic terrorism. Politicians and pundits on the right condemn the report as a smear on conservatives and a distraction from the real threat of Islamic extremism. The department's domestic anti-terrorism unit was subsequently discredited, defunded, and largely disbanded. Compared with the Aurora massacre, the Wisconsin shooting generated far less attention, said Renee Lynch in the Los Angeles Times. Perhaps that's because it's the fourth gun rampage this year alone, with mass killing sprees in an Oakland College classroom, a Seattle cafe, and the movie theater in Aurora. Now, when a heavily armed psycho mows down people, Americans are no longer shocked. Our response is weary resignation yet again. Now, also from the main story section, a rise in jobs and in unemployment as well. Fears that the economy might be slowing to a halt eased as the Labor Department reported that a better-than-expected 163,000 jobs were created in July, but the unemployment rate ticked up to 8.3% from the previous month's 8.2% as more people sought work. And the report offered no evidence that a more vigorous recovery was in the offing. The economy has added an average of 151,000 jobs every month this year, nearly identical to last year's rate of 153,000 jobs per month. While that is more than enough to keep up with population growth, job creation is still too weak to reduce the unemployment rate, which has now been over 8% for a record 41 months. President Obama blamed the slow recovery on the severity of the recession, but said the improving job numbers were proof that we'll gradually get to where we need to be. Republicans pointed to the rise in unemployment as evidence that Obama's policies were hampering economic recovery. Presumptive presidential nominee Mitt Romney called the report a hammer blow to middle-class families and said he would create 12 million new jobs in his first term. Middle-class Americans deserve better, and I believe Americans can do better, he said. Now here's what the editorial said. This was a Goldilocks and porridge kind of report, said the Chicago Tribune. Not too hot, not too cold, though not exactly just right. Worried businesses are evidently reluctant to hire more workers with the fiscal cliff looming at the end of December, when federal tax increases could collide with the $100 billion in forced spending cuts. You can thank President Obama for that, said the Wall Street Journal. His threat to let all the Bush tax cuts expire on January 1st if Congress doesn't raise taxes on the rich has left businesses stuck in a defensive crouch. Actually, congressional Republicans are to blame for the stagnant economy, said the New York Times. When consumer demand is low, the government must step in. The president proposed a jobs bill last year, but the House GOP blocked its passage, just as it is blocking the sensible tax reform required to avert the fiscal cliff. The real reason we're stuck is that we need more federal spending on education, infrastructure, and clean energy. Now here's what the columnist said. It pays to take a longer view of numbers like these, said John Cassidy in NewYorker.com. Then you can see that roller coaster job reports of the past 9 months were something of an illusion. When businesses didn't fire as many people as expected during the unseasonably warm winter, economists misread the job gains as a sign that the economy was returning to normal. Then they misinterpreted the slower rate of hiring in the spring as a slowdown. But the average monthly increase in payroll since November is 160,000 jobs. All in all, a decent figure. But that's not nearly enough, said Noam Schreiber in TNR.com. Remember, we need 100,000 just to keep up with population growth, and closer to 250,000 a month for the next 4 years to push unemployment back down to 5-6%. At this rate, we won't return to pre-recession job growth until well into the next decade. Americans shouldn't have to wait that long, said Erwin Stelzer in WeeklyStandard.com. Our anemic economy is a direct result of Obama's higher taxes, increased regulation, and wasteful stimulus spending. It should be clear that it is time for a change. That sentiment is the entire foundation of Mitt Romney's campaign, said Jonathan Bernstein in WashingtonPost.com. But history indicates that voters are more concerned with whether the economy is improving, not how strong it is overall. And the worse the economy is during a president's first year in office, the better voters perceive his efforts to turn things around, which is good news for Obama. That's why Romney had better give up thinking he'll win on the economy alone, said Daryl Delamade in MarketWatch.com. Voters need convincing that he has the policies and strength of character to make a better president than Obama. He has three more months in order to do that. Now let's turn to the controversy of the week, entitled Romney's Income Taxes. Is Reid's attack based on a lie? This is gutter politics of the lowest sort, said Richard Cohen in the Washington Post. Harry Reid, the Democratic Senate Majority Leader, last week accused presidential candidate Mitt Romney of paying no federal income taxes at all for 10 years. What proof did Reid offer for this implausible allegation? He claimed to have been tipped off by an extremely credible former investor at Bain Capital, the firm Romney once headed. When Romney challenged Reid to put up or shut up and name his source, said Rich Lowry in NationalReview.com, scurrilous Harry had the gall to repeat his accusation on the Senate floor, while insisting it was Romney's obligation to prove him wrong by releasing his tax returns prior to 2010. Coming from the highest-ranking elected Democrat in Congress, such McCarthyism is a disgrace. Reid is clearly carrying President Obama's water here, said Steve Kornacki in Salon.com. But there's a reason his allegation, crazy or not, has Republicans in such a lather. By bringing attention back to Romney's taxes, he's forcing the GOP nominee to address a topic he's badly trying to avoid. Romney, who's refused to release any returns other than those from 2010 and 2011, now faces the difficult choice of either giving in to Reid's demand for more returns or making it look like he's hiding something. Meanwhile, Reid could care less what Republicans are saying about him, because at 72, he's just 1 year into his last six-year Senate term and is thus immune to shaming, that is. He must be, said Mark Stein in NationalReview.com, given that Reid has never released his own tax returns. What an outrageous hypocrite. Reid's returns would be quite interesting to see, too, given that we have no idea by what fortuitous process a lifelong public service servant becomes a multimillionaire, as the Nevada Democrat has somehow managed to do. But Reid isn't running for president. Romney is, said Adam Sorensen in Time. And if Romney wants to win this election, he needs to release more tax returns prior to 2010. Whatever those returns contain, they can't be that explosive. People already know he's worth $250 million and paid just 13.9% in federal taxes in 2010. To win the election, Romney has to shift the spotlight to the president's handling of the economy, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial. That's why Romney should have released his tax returns long ago. Until he does, he's making his quest to oust an ineffective president harder than it should be. So why the continued secrecy, asked Alec McAllis in TNR.com, and why did a detail-oriented, calculating guy who's been running for president since at least 2006 fail to rid his personal finances of anything that could cause problems in a campaign? One theory, he just couldn't bear to cost himself any money. Famously a penny pincher, Romney is described by those who know him as having a true bottom-line mentality, devoted to amassing as much money as possible. This may explain why he claimed to be a full-time Utah resident to save on taxes, while still listing himself as the Massachusetts-based Bain's CEO, why he hid money in Swiss bank accounts, the Cayman Islands, and other questionable tax shelters, and why he apparently used even riskier tax tricks in the pre-2010 returns that he'd rather not share with voters. What those returns might reveal, I suspect, is that as much as Romney clearly wants to be president, it may not have been his ultimate priority after all. Now, from the main story section of the week, we'll turn to the popular column Good Week for and Bad Week for. It was a good week for bargain hunters after vendors set up the world's longest yard sale on a 690-mile stretch of U.S. Highway 127 from Alabama to Michigan. Featured were such bargains as old 45 RPM records, miniature donkeys, and used books like the Compendium of Methodism. It was a good week for hot air after a new analysis revealed that on a breezy day in April, 57% of the energy generated by Colorado's largest utility came from wind power, a U.S. record. And it was a good week for Isaac Lassen, 6 years old, of Salt Lake City, after doctors investigating his chronic sinus problems discovered a flexible Lego tire that the boy stuck up his nose when he was 3. Since the Lego was removed, Isaac has been eating and sleeping much better. It was a bad week for Stephen Feck, a German Olympic diver who slipped on one of his dives and landed in the water flat on his back as the crowd gasped. He received a 0.0 from every judge. It was a bad week for sitting on your duff after a global study found that the U.S. ranked among the most physically lazy countries in the world, with 40% of Americans engaging in little or no physical activity. Greece was found to be the most active country in the Western world, with just 15% inactive. And it was a bad week for Grand Theft Auto after Joshua Adam Carter, 25 years old, of Louisiana, tried to carjack an unmarked police car at a traffic light. Inside were a state police detective and 2 U.S. Marshals. "He's not one of your smarter ones," said a spokesman for the Marshal's office. And you're listening to our reading of the Week magazine for this week. Thanks for joining me here on the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Now we'll turn to the briefing section here. Our article is entitled "The Murder Case Roiling China." Bo Xilai was a rising political star until his wife Gu Kailai was charged with murder. What is this case all about? Why are Bo and Gu important? Known as the Kennedys of China, the couple had power, popularity, and glamour, and seemed destined to play a major role in that country's future. Bo Xilai, the son of one of Mao Zedong's generals and a leader of the party's left-wing neo-Maoist faction, was until recently a Politburo member who was climbing toward the top of the Communist Party hierarchy. As party boss of sprawling metropolitan Chongqing, he launched lavish government projects, called for the revival of communist ideology and Mao-era red songs, and steered a high-profile crackdown on organized crime. Bo's combination of charisma and ruthless ambition, and rumors that he was amassing millions through kickback schemes, made China's party leaders nervous. So did his wife, Gu Kailai, a sophisticated lawyer, who wrote a best-selling book that went on to spawn a popular TV drama. Their spectacular ascent came to a sudden end in February when Bo's police chief, Wang Lijun, showed up at a U.S. consulate with an extraordinary tale. What did Wang allege? He claimed that Gu personally ordered the killing of British businessman Neil Haywood, who had helped execute the family's business deals and some say had laundered its money. When Haywood's body was found in a Chongqing hotel in November, Chinese police said he had died of alcohol poisoning, but Wang told officials, U.S. officials a different story, that Gu asked Haywood to move a large sum of illicit money abroad, got angry when he asked for a bigger cut than expected, and then ordered one of her staff to poison him. Wang said he feared for his life after confronting Bo with his account, but he was denied asylum by the U.S. and disappeared into Chinese custody. What happened to Bo and Gu? The charges gave Bo's enemies all they needed to snuff out his high-flying career. Within a few weeks, he was removed as Chongqing governor and kicked out of the Politburo. He hasn't been seen in public since March. Gu was arrested in April, and late last month, she and an aide were indicted on murder charges. Her trial, expected to start August 9th, could be the country's biggest courtroom sensation since the 1980 treason trial of the so-called Gang of Four. The allegations against Gu have riveted the Chinese public, largely because the murder appears linked to the nest-feathering business activities that have made so many Chinese officials extremely rich. "This could really open a can of worms," said Bo Zhui, a senior fellow at Singapore's East Asian Institute. The relatives of other party leaders are also doing lots of business deals, and people will begin to ask, what about them? Was the Bo family the only one doing this kind of thing? What is China's media saying about all this? The state-run media is demonizing Gu as a grasping, power-hungry woman who had a man murdered out of greed. The political context is either ignored or denied. Xinhua, the state news agency, said there is irrefutable and substantial evidence of Gu's guilt. The state media's approach seems designed to blame Bo's downfall on his wife's wicked ways rather than on his ambitions to move up China's leadership ladder. It has nothing to do with a so-called political struggle, Xinhua insisted. Is that true? Well, many doubt it. This is a political rather than a legal case, said China scholar Steve Tsang of Nottingham University in the UK. Numerous Chinese officials and journalists have told American reporters that Bo, with Wang as his henchman, had used an extensive surveillance system, originally designed to uncover organized crime, to spy on visiting high-ranking officials. The last straw came when he tapped a call between a federal official visiting Chongqing and President Hu Hintao. When that wiretap was discovered, Politburo authorities ordered the party's Central Commission for Discipline Inspection to go after Wang and Bo. Wang then fled, fearing he would become the fall guy. Will Bo himself be tried? Almost certainly not. A trial that revealed details of top party officials spying on one another might be too embarrassing to the Communist Party. Bo's wife's implication in Haywood's murder offers a less damaging reason for his dramatic fall, and given China's conviction rate of 98%, a guilty verdict is a near certainty. Chinese officials want to be sure the affair is tidied up before the Politburo Standing Committee meets in the fall, or its once-a-decade transfer of power. Seven new members of the nine-member body are to be named, and Bo won't be among them. But the problem he embodies won't be so easily swept under the carpet. Failure to contain endemic corruption among Chinese officials, said Min-Seng Pei of Claremont McKenna College, poses one of the most serious threats to the nation's future economic and political stability. And the footnote to this briefing article is entitled A Pampered Son. In China, he's called the Princeling. Bo and Gu have a controversial son, Bo Guagua, 24, whose flamboyant displays of wealth as a student in the U.S. and the U.K. have strongly irritated the conservative guardians of the Communist Party. State media are now partly blaming the princeling for his mother's downfall, claiming that Gu wanted to get rich to give her son a privileged life abroad and had Haywood murdered because she feared he'd harm her son out of anger over their business differences. That explanation is part of the government's effort to portray the scandal as a purely personal matter and to avoid sensitive political discussions. The young Beau is certainly not a sympathetic figure for the average Chinese. He attended a Britain's elite Harrow prep school and then Oxford, and is a recent graduate of Harvard University's Kennedy School of Government. After the scandal broke, Beau wrote to the Harvard Crimson to deny news stories claiming that he had spent his college years partying, chasing women, and tooling around in a Ferrari. "I have never driven a Ferrari," he said. Harvard classmates say he actually drove a Porsche. Now, from the Week magazine, we'll move on to the best columns in the U.S. for this past week, according to the editors of the Week magazine. Our first column is entitled "The Truth About Voter Fraud." It was written by Richard L. Hasson in the New York Times. "Does voter fraud sometimes happen in the U.S.?" said political science professor Richard Hasson. "You bet, but after extensively studying voter fraud, I can tell you that voter ID laws would have no impact on the kind of fraud that can actually affect elections. The biggest source of fraud in recent years has been absentee ballots. It doesn't happen often, but partisan election officials have been caught throwing away thousands of ballots they'd rather not count. Republicans, however, do not want to rein in absentee ballots because most are cast by the military and the elderly, who tend to vote Republican. Instead, they focus on voter ID laws that would prevent individuals voting while pretending to be someone else. All evidence indicates that impersonation fraud is very rare, and that voter ID laws would mostly suppress legal votes by minorities who lack a photo ID. To avoid contested elections, we need sensible national voting standards, not a politically motivated hodgepodge of state laws. Sadly, it looks like things will have to get even worse before they get better." The next column is entitled "Tea Party Revolution Rolls On" by Michael Barone in NationalReview.com. "Surprise," said Michael Barone, "the mainstream media has already written off the Tea Party as dead and gone. But try telling that to Ted Cruz, the insurgent Texas Republican who scored a knockout win last week in a primary runoff for the Republican U.S. Senate nomination." Cruz, a Tea Party-backed Cuban-American attorney, won the nomination even though every establishment Republican in the Lone Star State, from Governor Rick Perry on down, endorsed David Dewhurst, the state's lieutenant governor. Cruz, a brilliant former U.S. Supreme Court clerk, is an eloquent advocate of constitutional principles and small government, and is the odds-on favorite to win in November. He has a big future in national politics, and Cruz is just one of several prospective new senators who won elections because of Tea Party support. In May, Richard Murdoch ousted six-time Senator Richard Lugar in the Indiana Senate primary, while Deb Fischer won the Senate primary in Nebraska after endorsements from Tea Party leaders like Sarah Palin. The media finds it flabbergasting, but millions of Americans long for a return to the constitutional principles established by the founders. That's why the Tea Party continues to reshape the political landscape. And the next column is entitled "Football Will Never Be Safe," and it's written by George Will in the Washington Post. "Are you ready for some football?" asked George Will. "First, however, are you ready for some autopsies?" The opening of the NFL training camps this year coincided with the results of an investigation into the suicide of former Atlanta Falcons star Ray Easterling. The autopsy found that the eight-season safety's brain had been ravaged by chronic traumatic encephalopathy, a condition caused by multiple concussions that leads to depression and dementia. Autopsies on other players who killed themselves or died early deaths have also revealed evidence of collision-caused brain damage. We can no longer deny that football permanently damages the bodies and brains of the 275-pound gladiators who inflict intimidating pain on each other for the nation's entertainment. Might Americans someday feel as queasy enjoying it as sensible people now do watching boxing? It may take a while for it all to sink in, but the game's essential savagery is getting harder and harder to ignore. Face it, it is a fiction that football can be fixed and still resemble the game fans relish. Now we'll turn to the health and science section of the Week magazine for this week. Our first article is entitled, Curiosity Touches Down on Mars. NASA's Curiosity rover landed on Mars this week after a staggeringly complex sequence of descent maneuvers, and scientists now hope it can start solving an abiding mystery, whether the red planet has ever been capable of harboring life. 8 months after blasting off from Earth, Curiosity penetrated the thin atmosphere of Mars at 13,200 miles per hour. With the help of a giant parachute and descent rockets, the spacecraft slowed and then hovered as it deployed a specialized design sky crane to gently lower the car-sized rover to the surface. It will take engineers more than a week to determine whether the $2.5 billion rover survived the landing in full working condition. If it did, we have a real analytical laboratory on the surface of Mars, NASA scientist John M. Grunsfeld tells the New York Times. Curiosity houses cameras and 10 state-of-the-art instruments designed to test the Martian atmosphere and sediment. Among them, a rock vaporizing laser that can convert rocks up to 20 feet away into gas to reveal their chemical makeup. Since NASA's Viking probe landed on Mars in 1976, scientists have gathered reams of data on conditions there. But Curiosity, the most sophisticated planetary rover ever built, is equipped to provide a much fuller picture of the planet. The nuclear-powered vehicle will roll from its landing site on the floor of the 3.5-billion-year-old Gale crater toward 3-mile-high Mount Sharp. Heading up the mountain, it will encounter layers of increasingly young rock, giving scientists their first look at Mars' geologic history. Scientists know that the Gale crater once contained water. They hope to now discover whether clays and minerals there contain carbon, one of the building blocks of life. Any evidence that conditions for life exist on Mars, says NASA scientist James Green, will force us to radically rethink our place in the universe. And now we'll look at the health scare of the week. Could seal flu infect humans? A mutant bird flu that killed more than 150 seals in New England last summer might be able to make the leap to humans. Researchers at Columbia University have discovered that a virus known as H3N8, which normally infects only birds, has acquired 37 mutations that allow it to spread among seals and potentially to other mammals. Whenever you get a virus that spills over from one disease into another and causes disease, that is a significant concern, researcher Simon Anthony tells dailymail.co.uk. At least one of the seal flu's mutations could allow it to target the human respiratory tract, and with a few more adaptations, it may well start to move into humans, says researcher W.E.N. Lipkin. Scientists aren't sure what effect H3N8 might have on people, but another bird flu, H5N1, has killed more than half of the some 600 people infected since 2003. HIV, SARS, and West Nile fever, Lipkin notes, are all infectious diseases that originated in animals. Now from the Triangle Radio Reading Service, the Week magazine turns to the back of the magazine here, and we'll look at the last word. The article this week is entitled, Almost Perfect. In a Texas bowling alley, says Michael Mooney, Bill Fong came so close to perfection that it nearly killed him. When Bill Fong approaches the lane, he tries not to breathe. He wants his body to perform a series of complex movements that his muscles themselves have memorized. Fong, 48 years old, 6 feet tall, with broad shoulders, pulls the ball into his chest and does a quick shimmy with his hips. He takes 5 measured steps toward the foul line and releases the ball. It glides across the oiled wooden planks, and as it nears the edge of the lane, it veers back toward the center, as if guided by remote control. In a heartbeat, what was a wide, sneering mouth of pins is now nothing. He comes back to the table where his teammates are seated. They always sit and bowl in the same order, and they congratulate him the same way they have thousands of times over the last decade. But Fong looked displeased. "I got pretty lucky that time," he says in his distinctly Chicago accent. "The 7 was hanging there before it fell. I've got to make adjustments." With a pencil, he jots down notes on a folded piece of blue paper. His teammates aren't interested in talking about what he can do to make his strikes more solid, though, or even tonight's mildly competitive league game. They're still discussing a night 2 years ago. They mention it every week without fail. In fact, all you have to do is say the words, "that night," and everyone at the Plano Super Bowl knows what you're talking about. One man, an opponent of Fong's that evening, calls it the most amazing thing I've ever seen in a bowling alley. Bill Fong needs no reminders, of course. He thinks about the moment, those hours, every single day of his life. Most people think perfection in bowling is a 300 game, but it isn't. Any reasonably good recreational bowler can get lucky one night and roll 12 consecutive strikes. If you count all the bowling alleys all over America, somebody somewhere bowls a 300 every night. But only a human robot can roll 3 300s in a row, 36 straight strikes for what's called a perfect series. More than 95 million Americans go bowling, but according to the United States Bowling Congress, there have been only 21 certified 900s since anyone started keeping track. Bill Fong's run at perfection started, as most of his nights do, with a practice at around 5:30 p.m. He bowls in 4 active leagues and rolls at least 20 games a week every week. That night, January 18, 2010, he wanted to focus on his timing. He didn't roll many strikes in practice, though. There was nothing to make him think this night would be anything special. Fong's team, the Crazy Eights, was assigned lanes 27 and 28, one of Fong's favorite pairs. The left lane, 27, hooks more, he says. The right lane, 28, tends to be more direct. When it was Fong's turn, he opted to roll a deeper hook to stay outside and ride the edge of the gutter a little longer. His ball slammed into the pocket, obliterating all 10 pins. His next roll, on 28, was another violent strike. All 4 of the first frames were robust strikes, actually. "To tell you the truth, that wasn't that unusual," says Joanne Gibson, a sweet southern woman who enjoys the company more than she does the actual bowling. Gibson and teammate Tom Dunn have bowled with or against Fong in this league since the Clinton administration. They don't really hang out much outside the bowling alley, but no matter what's going on in life, they go to Plano Super Bowl for a few hours on Monday nights. In the 6th frame, Fong had another loud, devastating strike, then another. With each throw, he could tell it was a strike from the moment it left his hand. It felt like driving and catching a green light, then the next one, and then the next one, then turning and still catching every green light everywhere you go, Fong says. On the last roll of the 10th frame, though, something happened. He could tell from the sound of the pins, as the clutter at the end of the lane cleared, he could see the 9 pin still standing. He watched the chaos of the flying pins, each rotating right past the upright 9. Fong craned his neck, watching, hoping, until one of the pins popped up from its side and swiped the 9 down. In his second game, it was like Moses parting the sea, he says. I'd move my hands and everything would get out of the way. By the 10th frame, Fong found that most people around him wouldn't make eye contact for fear they would be the last thing he would see before rolling a dud. On the first roll of the last frame, he had what he calls a happy accident. For the first time that night, one of his powerful throws missed its mark ever so slightly, but because the oil was now evaporating, the ball found the pocket for a perfect strike. Noticing what happened on the first roll, he adjusted his position and finished the game with two more powerful strikes, numbers 23 and 24 of the night. Never seen anything like it, his teammate said. Back-to-back 300s. Fong shook his head. Me neither, he said. There's almost never a time when every decision you make is correct and every step is in the right direction. Life, like bowling, is full of complicating factors. Fong, a C student turned college dropout, divorced young and never made much money. Nothing in his life had gone according to plan. But when that first roll of the third game produced another strike, Fong felt like he was floating. He wasn't drinking, but he felt a little drunk. By the time he struck in the fifth frame, he realized that he would almost certainly break the coveted 800 mark. By the sixth frame, a large crowd had formed. Dozens of people had stopped bowling to watch. Texts were sent and statuses posted to Facebook, and the audience grew. We were more nervous than he was at the time, Gibson says. It was almost like he was putting on a show up there. Each time he approached the lane, the bowling alley went silent. Each time he struck, the room erupted with applause. In all his life, Bill Fong had never heard anyone cheering him like that. He had 33 straight strikes entering the 10th frame of the third game. Out came the cell phone cameras. There were whispers, but as soon as Fong picked up his ball, it was dead quiet. He turned to look at the crowd behind him, now well over 100 people, densely packed from the end of the snack bar to the vending machines 80 feet away. That's when Fong began to feel nervous, like the world was watching him pee. He felt the buzz, whatever it had been, leave his body. As he stood in front of lane 28, he felt numb. He lined up and threw a ball without much hook on it. As soon as it left his hand, Fong began waving at it, trying to will the ball left. It connected with the pocket, but without the usual force. As the other pins dropped, the 9 pin stayed up for what seemed like ages. But just as the gasp of the crowd reached a peak, one of the pins, rolling meekly across the lane, bumped the 9 just enough to tip it. The room exploded with cheers and whistles. Fong looked dizzy as he walked back to the ball exchange. He was sweating profusely, but he realized the mistake he'd made on his last throw, and the second roll was much cleaner. Again, there were shouts from the audience as the ball blazed down the lane, zipping back in time to smash the pins apart in a powerful driving strike. 35 strikes down, 1 to go. Before his final roll, Fong wiped his ball with his towel. He lifted the ball to his chest and stood calmly for a moment. Then he took 5 steps and released the ball. It looked good from his hand, arcing out the way so many of his great strikes that night had, cutting back to the pocket just in time. Several people started applauding before the ball even reached the end of the lane. That's how good it looked. But this time, as the pin scrambled, something unimaginable happened. The number 10 pen, farthest to the right, wobbled, but it didn't fall. Some of the people in the room couldn't process what they just witnessed. How could the last roll, like the 35 before it, not be a strike? Strangers fell to their knees. It was hard for anyone to breathe. Fong turned and walked to his right. He was empty, blank, as he stood there. Fong wanted to say something, anything, but he couldn't make a sound. That night his friends bought him a few beers. He doesn't usually drink, but at the time he felt like the best day of his life had just turned into the worst. After a beer or two, at least an hour of excited congratulations from strangers, he felt dizzy. When he got home, he went into the bathroom and vomited in the toilet. The walls were spinning. It turns out Fong was having a stroke. With the stress and tension of the night, his already high blood pressure had reached dangerous levels. Not long after, he had another stroke. When the doctor saw the x-rays and heard about the night of dizziness, he explained to Fong that he had suffered what could very easily have been a fatal stroke. That night at the bowling alley, he could have died. It also means that with the sweating and dizziness he was feeling in the third game, it's likely that Fong bowled the last few frames through the beginning of that stroke, which makes the accomplishment that much more amazing, mind-boggling, Gibson says. When he had his heart surgery, he was in the hospital for a week. Not many family members visited him, but he didn't lack for visitors. Plenty of people from the bowling alley took the time to see him, to ask him how he felt, and encourage him to get well quickly. And one by one, they each mentioned that incredible night in January when Bill Fong fell just one pin short of perfect. Rehab was hard at first. The strokes took a lot of his strength. But within a few months, earlier than doctors recommend, Fong was back to his usual form, back to rolling 5 days a week, as they're talking about that night. One of his teammates poses the question, would Fong rather be alive with an 899 or dead with a perfect 900? It's a rhetorical question, but Fong takes a moment to consider it seriously. He's gone over that last roll so many times in his mind, replayed the shaky cell phone video. It takes him another moment or maybe two, but eventually Bill Fong says he'd rather be alive. And that piece was excerpted from a longer piece in D Magazine, copyrighted in 2012 and read, of course, with permission. Now, from the last word, we'll go to the Talking Points section of the Week magazine, an assortment of articles in the news for this past week. Our first one is entitled, Phelps, the Greatest Olympian of All Time. When swimmer Michael Phelps took yet another gold medal in London this past week, said John Leister in the Associated Press, no one could disagree with the bedsheet unfurled by fans in the crowd that said Phelps' greatest Olympian ever. Phelps, who is 27 years old, ended his Olympic career with an astonishing total of 18 gold medals and 22 total medals. By winning another four golds in London, he easily surpassed the previous record of Soviet gymnast Larissa Latynina and Cam Cole in the Vancouver Sun. Said Cam Cole in the Vancouver Sun, Latynina, let's remember, was awarded her 18 medals in a subjective sport in which capricious, often biased judges decide who wins. Phelps won his medals by being faster than anybody from here to there. Without question, he's the greatest Olympic athlete of all time. Perhaps he is by sheer medals won, said Robert Colville in the Daily Telegraph, but other athletes deserve to be in that same pantheon. British rower Sir Steve Redgrave won gold medals at five consecutive Olympiads. Romanian gymnast Nadia Comăneci scored the first perfect tens in Olympic history. Russian wrestler Alexander Karelin dominated every opponent over three Olympics. Phelps won so many medals because swimming is salami sliced into a large number of slightly different events, each testing the same basic skill. Swimming is also relatively easy on the body, said Philip Hirsch in the Los Angeles Times. Track and field star Carl Lewis, who retired with 10 medals, 9 of them gold, was competing in explosive events that strained tendons, ligaments, and muscles to the limit, shortening his career. Phelps may be the greatest swimmer of all time, but Lewis was the greatest pure athlete. The Olympics aren't really about medals, said Sam Mellinger in the Kansas City Star. The Olympics are about moments. From Tommy Smith's black glove salute to Carrie Strug sticking her landing on an injured ankle. Those images are why we care about the games. From that perspective, no one can touch Jesse Owens, the black U.S. sprinter who won four golds at the 1936 Berlin Games to the immense displeasure of the watching Adolf Hitler. Owens earned a very special place in history, said Michael Farber in SportsIllustrated.com. But one reason we love sports is that, unlike life, the results are measurable. So while honorable pedants and poets may disagree, the simple mathematical fact is that Phelps' 22 medals put his Olympic supremacy beyond dispute. Our next article is entitled Education, the Case Against Algebra. Is algebra really necessary? Asked Andrew Hacker in the New York Times. America's high schools require all students to take algebra and other advanced math, from geometry through calculus. But for millions, this obstacle course of abstract equations is sheer misery. In many states, testing shows that more than a third of students fail to rate as proficient in algebra. Teachers tell me that math classes make some students feel stupid and are a major reason why as many as 30% of kids drop out, especially among minorities. So why do we subject American students to this ordeal? Rather than force math-averse students to grapple with vectorial angles and discontinuous functions that no non-engineer will ever use, why not focus on true quantitative literacy? That would mean teaching statistics, budgeting skills, and math used in public and personal life, while removing the onerous stumbling block that algebra presents to higher education. Can you possibly be serious? Said Daniel Willingham in the Washington Post. Learning algebra and other abstract math teaches students how to use logic and step-by-step analysis to solve problems, a skill transferable to real life. It's no accident that strong math and science skills are robust predictors of individual income and of a country's economic growth. Besides, said Evelyn Lamb in ScientificAmerican.com, algebra really isn't as abstract and esoteric as people think. It underlies technology and science that we use every day, from our smartphones to our cars. Limiting its teaching to prospective engineers will only serve to increase the disparity between those who get it and those who don't. As for the argument that you don't need algebra in most jobs, by that standard, we should also stop requiring students to read Hamlet and The Old Man and the Sea. Yet my life would not be as rich if I had never been exposed to great literature. The same is true of algebra. Sounds like someone who got an A in algebra, said Richard Cohen in the Washington Post. Bully for you. But in my math classes, I never understood a word the teacher was saying, and I got absolutely nothing out of them except a migraine. Nevertheless, I've had a successful career and make daily use of what I learned in English, geography, and history. But if you ask me, or most adults, when a train leaving New York will pass a train leaving Los Angeles at twice the speed, we'll tell you, who cares? Now we'll read from a few of the shorter items in the Talking Points section as we near the end of our program for this week. Of the 41 missions sent to Mars by various space agencies, 26 have failed. The failed spacecraft have blown up in Earth's atmosphere, gone awry or silent on the journey through space, crashed on Mars, or failed to operate after landing. Amtrak has managed to lose $834 million on its food and beverage services over the past decade, largely because of waste, poor management, and employee theft, government auditors have told Congress. Record-setting performances by women athletes in running and swimming events have steadily gotten closer to men's, and their times are now just about 90% as fast in all such events. American swimming star Ryan Lochte admits he sometimes pees in the pool and he has plenty of company. Nearly 100% of elite competitive swimmers pee in the pool, said Carly Gear, a former U.S. Olympian. As a swimmer, you just have to accept the fact that you're swimming in pee. Interesting follow-up to the Olympics for this year. And the population of Amish in North America is doubling every 22 years and could reach 1 million by mid-century. A new study reveals in 1990 there were 179 settlements of the religious group, which eschews cars, electricity, contraception, and modern culture. Now there are 456 settlements. Now let's take a look at some famous quotes here under the article titled Wit and Wisdom in the Week magazine. The United States was founded by the brightest people in the country, and we haven't seen them since. And that was said by Gore Vidal, and he was quoted in The Guardian UK. The next quote, people never lie so much as after a hunt, during a war, or before an election. And that was a quote from Otto von Bismarck, quoted in the Montreal Gazette. If one cannot do great work, it is worthwhile to do work and think it's great. That was said by Ambrose Bierce. He was quoted in the Salt Lake City Desert News. Sentiment without action is the ruin of the soul, said Edward Abbey, as quoted in the Austin Chronicle. Now we'll look at the poll watch for this week. 23% of adults say the shootings in Aurora, Colorado make them feel less safe in movie theaters, and 8% say they've avoided movie theaters as a result of that. And when asked what they would be most embarrassed to be seen reading, 61% chose Nicole Snooki Pulitzi's novel, A Sure Thing, 13% said The National Enquirer, 5% a memoir by President Obama, and 10% said a memoir by Mitt Romney. Only 12% said they wouldn't want to be seen reading the erotic novel called 50 Shades of Grey. Just about run out of time for today's episode of The Week magazine. Be sure to listen again next time. I certainly hope you enjoyed it. I'm George Douglas. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. It's available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. So long until next time.